We picked the place because it was cheap and close to the lake. No weird photos, no typos in the description, no odd messages from the host. The reviews looked fine. We didn't overthink it. 2 nights, quick break. Done. We just wanted to sleep, eat, and maybe swim. Tara booked it under her account. We got there late afternoon. The building looked a little older than in the photos. The paint was cracked around the windows. The hallway smelled like bleach. Still, nothing screamed danger. We used the lockbox, got inside. Small kitchen, one bedroom, a living room with an old couch, and a window facing an alley. All clean. No personal items. Nothing creepy. We unpacked, ate noodles, and went to bed. We didn't even check the closet or drawers. No reason to. The door had a double lock, which we used. We left our bags on the floor and fell asleep without saying goodnight. We were too tired to care. That night was quiet. Too quiet, now that I think about it. Around 3 a.m., I heard something that pulled me out of my sleep. It wasn't loud, but it was steady. Not the kind of sound you dream of. It was footsteps, slow and careful, coming from the hallway outside the bedroom. I sat up and looked at Tara. She was breathing evenly, still asleep. I stayed still, trying to figure out if I was wrong. The steps stopped. Then there was a low creak, like someone shifting weight, just beyond the bedroom door. I got out of my bed and checked it, still locked from the inside. I unlocked it slowly and peeked out. The hallway was empty. All the lights were off. Nothing moved. The kitchen was untouched. The front door was locked. I checked every window. They were closed. No sign of forced entry. Nothing stolen. I told Tara in the morning. She laughed it off, said maybe the upstairs neighbors made the noise. I didn't believe that, but I let it go. That evening, after a long day out, we came back to the apartment and found the front door slightly open. Not wide, just enough to notice it hadn't clicked shut. We had locked it that morning. I was sure of it. So was Tara. That second night, we took it seriously. We pushed a chair under the doorknob, locked all the windows, and kept a kitchen knife near the bed. We even locked the bedroom from the inside. Neither of us joked. We lay in bed with our phones on the nightstand, both staring at the ceiling. I couldn't fall asleep. It started with a light scratching sound, then another. Not from the hallway this time, but from behind the bedroom wall. I looked at Tara. Her eyes were open too. We both heard it. Then came something worse. The sound of breathing. Slow. Deep and so close, it couldn't be on the other side of the wall. It was coming from inside. The room was dead silent except for that sound. My hand went to my phone, but I didn't unlock it. I just listened. The breathing stopped. Then came a loud tap. 1, 2, 3. Right in the center of the wall. I stood up and pressed my ear against the drywall. Nothing now but my own pulse in my head. We grabbed the flashlight app and started checking the room. We moved the beds, looked under them, and opened every drawer. In the closet behind a row of jackets, we found a thin vertical crack. Not just a crack, an opening. Someone had cut into the wall and sealed it badly. The gap was black, deep, and narrow. But the inside wasn't empty. We both heard movement inside, like someone was crawling back away from the light. Tara slammed the closet door shut and we pushed the dresser in front of it. Neither of us said anything. There was nothing to say. We tried to leave, but the front door wouldn't budge. The knob turned halfway and then locked up. We pulled, kicked, even unscrewed the knob. Nothing worked. Every window had a latch that was painted shut. We checked the kitchen. There was no fire escape, no exit. Tara pulled the fridge out, thinking maybe there was something behind it. And there was. A small hole in the drywall, perfectly round like someone drilled it intentionally. We used her phone light to look inside. There was another wall just a few inches back, and scratches. Deep, desperate ones. We kept looking. Behind the mirror in the bathroom, I found another hole. This one had hair stuck in it. Human hair. Light brown. Fresh. Tara wanted to scream, but she didn't. We just kept moving. In the living room behind the bookcase, the drywall had been patched badly. I pushed on it, and the panel shifted. It opened with a crack. Inside, there was a hidden tunnel. Not big, but big enough to crawl through. It reeked like rotting meat and mold. There were pieces of broken plastic, bits of rope, and torn clothes. At the far end, the tunnel dropped into darkness. I didn't want to go in. Neither did Tara. We had no choice. We couldn't stay above ground with whatever was watching us. We grabbed the flashlight, the knife, and crawled in. The tunnel was hot and cramped. My knees scraped against nails. I couldn't turn around. Tara followed behind me, breathing hard. After maybe 20 feet, the tunnel opened into a small chamber. No paint, no insulation, just plywood and rot. There was no light except what our phones gave off. The first thing we saw was a child's mattress. Then two more. All lined up. Dirty, stained, sunken in the middle. The room smelled like piss and blood. In the corner was a bucket. Full. In another corner. Bones. Small ones. Too small to be from animals. Tara covered her mouth, but she didn't look away. There were photos taped to the wall. Dozens. Polaroids. Kids sitting on those same mattresses. Some crying. Some gagged. Some stared at the camera like they'd given up. There were dates written on them. Some from years ago. Some recent. I turned and saw something sticking out of the floorboards. It was a hand. Small. Dry. Mummified. The fingers were curled. Tara dropped to her knees and started sobbing quietly. That's when we heard the noise. The tunnel behind us creaked. Someone was inside it. Crawling. We scrambled out of the room and back to the tunnel. I scraped my leg on a nail, but didn't stop. Tara dropped her phone, but kept on going in the dark. We crawled as fast as we could. Behind us, someone was following. The sound was heavy, fast, and close. We burst out into the apartment and slammed the panel shut behind us. I ran for the front door. Still locked. We screamed, banged on the walls, and kicked the furniture. And a voice came from the kitchen. Calm. Male. Quiet. Like he'd been watching us.
You two weren't supposed to find that.
He stepped into view. Mid-40s. Pale. His shirt was soaked in sweat. His eyes were blank. Like he wasn't fully there. He had a crowbar in one hand and a key ring in the other. Tara threw a lamp at him and missed. I rushed him with the knife and got his arm. He hit me in the face with a crowbar, and I went down. My vision was blurred. He grabbed Tara and slammed her against the wall. She kicked, bit his hand, and scratched his face. I got up and stabbed him in the back, deep. He dropped her and started screaming. Before we could run, the hallway lights flickered, and for just a second, we saw them. Shadows, thin, fast-moving, darting past the doorway. Children. Silent. Dozens of them. Their outlines were barely visible. But they were there. Watching us. Then gone. We ran back to the bedroom, locked the door, and pushed the bed and dresser against it. He pounded for 10 seconds. Then, sirens. The police found him in the hallway, bleeding and dazed. he didn't run. His real name was Martin Doyle. He owned the building. He'd been using fake profiles to rent that unit for over a decade. At least 10 children had gone missing nearby in that time. The bones matched several open cases. They searched the walls and found a full network of tunnels. Not just one hidden space, but an entire complex running behind and beneath the units. He had modified the structure years ago, connecting multiple apartments through the walls and floors. It allowed him to move undetected, to stalk, to snatch, to hide.
I had been renting out my secluded cabin on Airbnb for nearly 6 years, tucked away in the Appalachian foothills. It was the kind of place where people booked when they wanted to disappear for a while. No neighbors, no cell service, no noise. Just thick woods, silence, and the illusion of safety. I only visited between bookings to restock essentials and clean. The isolation never bothered me, until this time. The booking came from 3 guests, Marcus, Lila, and Jonah. Their profiles seemed fine, normal pictures, generic bios. They said they wanted a break from the city and to reconnect with nature. They were polite in their messages, nothing weird. I approved them without thinking twice. They arrived on Monday. I drove out to meet them in person. Standard routine, mostly to make sure they weren't the partying type. They got out of a gray SUV, each carrying only a backpack. That struck me as odd. A week in a cabin, no supplies. Still, they smiled, shook my hand, and didn't ask any questions. Just nodded when I gave them the key and said, "We won't be any trouble." Midweek, I realized I hadn't heard from them. Most guests usually sent a message asking about the fireplace or how to get the hot water going. But these three, nothing. I sent a quick check-in through the app. "Hey, just making sure everything's okay." No response. A day passed. Still nothing. I figured maybe they were just the off-grid type. That's why people booked the place after all. But something gnawed at me. Call it instinct or paranoia. I don't know. By Friday night, I gave in to the unease and drove up to the cabin. It was just past 10 p.m. when I pulled into the driveway. No lights were on. The woods were unusually still. Not even the sound of crickets. That's when I noticed the front door. It was slightly ajar. My stomach tightened. I approached slowly, calling out, "Hello? Marcus? Lila?" No answer. Just a creak of the floorboards under my feet. The air inside hit me like a wall, thick with the stench of burnt wax and something worse. Something metallic. The living room glowed faintly. Black candles flickered on every surface, some still burning, others melted into grotesque puddles. Red light bulbs replaced the regular ones, bathing the room in a nauseating hue. Symbols, jagged, erratic, unfamiliar, were drawn all over the walls and floor in what looked like lipstick, or blood, or both. The kitchen reeked, the fridge door hung open, contents rotting. Symbols covered the counters, even the inside of the microwave, drawn carefully, obsessively. There were feathers in the sink, nails, human, I think, scattered across the table. I backed away, heading for the door, when something cracked against the back of my skull. Pain exploded, then darkness. I woke up tied to a wooden chair in the living room. The candles were still burning. My arms were numb, wrists bound tight. I couldn't move. In front of me stood Marcus, holding a knife. Not a kitchen knife. Something older. Ceremonial. Lila and Jonah stood on either side, both holding tubes of that same dark red lipstick. None of them spoke. Their faces were blank, like masks. They began drawing symbols on my chest, arms, even my face. The lipstick felt freezing cold. Marcus stepped forward and made a shallow cut on my forehead with the knife. Blood ran down my face. I tried to scream. But something was stuffed in my mouth. A rag. It tasted like wax and mold. Then they started chanting. It wasn't English. It sounded Latin. But twisted. Harsh consonants. Guttural vowels. The sound vibrated in my chest like it didn't belong in this world. I writhed against the restraints. But the ropes only dug deeper into my skin. I lost track of time. Minutes. Hours. I don't know. At some point, I noticed movement outside of the window. A figure standing in the trees. Not one of them. Something else. Just watching. My eyes locked on it. But when I blinked, it was gone. Then a knock at the door. Sharp. Repeated. 3 times. It echoed like a gunshot. The 3 cultists froze. Marcus raised his hand and motioned for silence. Lila moved towards the door, but he grabbed her arm and shook his head. They whispered, tense now, frantic. Something about not ready. I couldn't hear all of it. I tried to scream, hoping whoever was outside would hear. Jonah shoved his hand over my mouth. The knocking returned, louder this time. Then, voices. 2 people. 1 male. 1 female. Couldn't make out the words. They knocked again. Then silence. The cultists waited a few moments before exhaling in unison. Whatever hope I had disappeared as quickly as it came. They resumed their positions. This time, Marcus dipped his fingers into a bowl and smeared something oily over my wound. It stung like acid. He leaned close and whispered, "Just a vessel, nothing more." I don't remember what happened next. I passed out. The pain, the blood loss, the fear. Everything went black. I woke up in daylight. The candles had melted down. The cabin was silent. I was alone, still bound to the chair. The symbols were still there. Some had faded. Others seemed fresher. I managed to free myself and stumble outside. My phone was missing, and there was no sign of the guest. I drove to the nearest town and contacted the authorities. An investigation ensued, but no trace of Marcus, Lila, or Jonah was ever found. They deleted their profiles, faked their IDs. No, there is no record of their vehicle, like they never existed. I spent 3 days in the hospital. I had a concussion, shallow lacerations, signs of drug exposure. My sleep was plagued with vivid nightmares. The chanting, the figure in the woods, the knife. Months have passed since that night. Despite numerous treatments, the scar on my forehead persists. A constant reminder of the ordeal. I no longer rent out the cabin, unable to return to that place. I share my story as a cautionary tale. You should never think that people are good just because of their appearance, and people who think that crazy people are always walking around with a bell on their foot usually fall victim to them.
I rented my apartment for 1 week. Just 1 week. I needed the money, and I didn't think much about who I was letting in. His name was Alec Carter. Mid-30s, business consultant, quiet, polite, didn't ask questions. He booked fast and showed up early. When I handed him the keys, he barely looked me in the eye. He had no bags, just a black backpack and a metal case, like the kind people use for tools. He didn't smile once. I gave him a quick tour, told him where things were, and left. I didn't feel unsafe, just like he wasn't really listening. When the week ended, he left right on time. The apartment looked clean. No broken furniture, no smells, nothing weird. But something felt different. I didn't know what yet, but something was off. And once I found the painting, I knew I wasn't imagining it. The map was gone. That map had been in the living room since I moved in. A giant canvas of the world in pale blues and browns. I loved it. What replaced it was bigger, darker. A war painting. Soldiers with burned faces, black skies, bodies piled up in trenches. It wasn't even centered on the wall, just hammered in like someone needed it there. At first I thought maybe I was wrong. Maybe Alex swapped it by accident, or maybe it was some weird thank you gift. I opened a drawer to call the Airbnb support number, and that's when I noticed the silverware had been rearranged. Each knife is facing the exact same angle. Even the dish towels were folded perfectly, edges aligned. I never do that. I started opening every drawer and cabinet. He'd touched everything. Rearranged shoes. My books are in alphabetical order. Bathroom bottles placed by height. Nothing was missing, but nothing was mine anymore. Every room looked like a showroom version of itself. Clean, sterile, inhuman. That night, I couldn't sleep. I kept thinking about that painting. Why would anyone bring something like that? And why leave it? I wanted to feel normal again, so I turned on the TV while making coffee. It buzzed, flashed once, then settled on a strange feed. Not a channel, a live stream. The screen showed a bedroom. My bedroom. From the corner ceiling. I stood still, coffee dripping onto the floor. My bed, my blanket, my lamp. The timestamp was live. I checked behind the TV. Nothing new. No cables out of place. The remote wasn't even near me. I grabbed my phone, pointed it at the screen, and recorded 10 seconds. Then I ran to the bedroom. I looked up to where the angle was coming from. Nothing there. No lens, no black dot, no blinking light. But the stream was real. I went room to room, tapping walls, looking under furniture. I tore open the heating vents with a screwdriver. Nothing. But when I moved the fridge, I found something taped behind it. A round black device, like a smoke detector, but flat and silent. I took it off and opened the battery case. There was no battery, just a red light that went dark the second I cracked it open. By then, I had goosebumps on my arms. Not from cold, from the way my space didn't feel like mine anymore. I didn't know how long he'd been watching me, maybe even before I left him the key. I was done playing calmly. I called the police. They said someone would come by. No one did. I barely slept. Every creak in the walls made me sit up. At 3:11 a.m., the TV turned on by itself. Same live stream. My room again. Except this time, the bed wasn't empty. Someone was sitting on it. My back tensed up and I froze. I could only see the top of their head. Short hair, pale scalp, not moving. I grabbed a bat I kept by the door. I walked to the bedroom and pushed it open fast. Empty. But the bed had a dent right in the center. Deep, like someone had just gotten up. The air wasn't cold, but it was dry. I didn't turn off the TV. I left it playing and sat on the couch, holding the bat. Around 4:30 a.m., I heard something inside the kitchen wall, like soft movement. I pressed my ear to the drywall. There was a shuffle, a bump, then silence. I punched the wall. Nothing answered. That morning, I packed a bag. I was going to leave, but when I opened the door, the hallway was pitch black. The lights were out. I stepped forward, but the elevator display was off, and the stairwell door wouldn't open. It was like the building had shut itself off. I went back inside, closed every window, and locked myself in the bathroom. I stayed there until I heard voices outside again. Normal ones. Neighbors talking about the power outage. I waited until daylight to search again. I pulled every frame off the wall, every vent, every floorboard I could pry open. I found 5 more cameras. 2 in the living room, 1 in the bathroom light fixture, 1 in a kitchen cabinet, and the last inside my nightstand drawer, facing upward. I smashed them all. The only place I hadn't checked was the crawl space under my apartment. There was a hatch in the hallway closet. I opened it and climbed down with a flashlight and a hammer. It was tight, full of dust and old wires. Then I saw something move at the end of the space. A pair of legs. Someone was standing, facing the wall. I aimed my light. It was Alec, standing perfectly still, wearing my robe. He turned around slowly and smiled like he'd been waiting for me. Then he charged. He tackled me hard, slammed my back into a pipe. I swung the hammer and hit his shoulder. He didn't scream, just grabbed my wrist and bit down on it until I dropped the tool. I punched his jaw and scrambled backward. He crawled after me like he didn't feel pain. I made it to the hatch and kicked at his face. He caught my ankle and pulled, but I clawed at the edge and screamed loud enough for someone upstairs to hear. He let go, disappeared into the dark. When I got out, the hatch slammed shut behind me. I locked it with a chair and called the cops again. This time, I told them someone had broken in. Armed, violent. They came fast. They found nothing. No man, no prints, no cameras, nothing. The crawl space was empty. Just dust and old wires, like before. They looked at me like I was crazy, but they didn't say it. One of the officers pulled me aside. He said Alec Carter didn't exist. The ID he used was fake. The photo was AI-generated. The phone number was untraceable. I moved out that same week. Sold everything. The map painting, my TV, my furniture. I couldn't keep any of it. Not knowing what he'd touched, what he'd recorded, where he might have hidden more. 2 months later, I was staying with a friend in another city. One night I was scrolling through videos online. A link came up in a chat. No sender, just a file. I clicked it. The video started with my front door. Then I, cooking. Me sleeping, me changing, all stitched together hour by hour, day by day.
I wasn't supposed to be there. I was just checking my Airbnb rental before heading back to the city. It was a small house in Omaha, nothing fancy. My last guests had been quiet, no complaints, and the house should have been empty now. But when I drove by, something caught my eye. The door was open. That wasn't right. I double-checked my phone for the guest calendar. No one was scheduled until next week. I parked a little down the street and decided to take a closer look. Maybe the cleaners had left it open by mistake. Or worse, maybe someone broke in. My heartbeat picked up as I approached the porch. I reached the doorway and peered inside. The living room was untouched. Same cheap furniture, same stale air. But then, a faint chemical smell hit me. Sharp and unnatural. It wasn't the kind of thing you mistake for cleaning products. I stepped in cautiously. The smell grew stronger as I approached the kitchen. That's when I heard the faint hum of machinery. It was coming from the basement door, which was cracked open, just enough for a dim flickering light to spill out. I should have turned around right then. But I couldn't. Something told me I needed to see what was going on. The basement was a different world. Fluorescent lights buzzed overhead, illuminating an elaborate setup that looked straight out of a crime show. Rows of burners, glass tubes, and vats of liquid lined the walls. The smell down there was unbearable, a cocktail of chemicals that burned my nose and throat. But the worst part wasn't the equipment. It was the people. At least five of them were in the room, all wearing hazmat suits. They moved frantically, glancing at each other as if something had already gone wrong. I froze at the bottom of the stairs. One of them turned their head, and I could feel their gaze through the opaque visor of their mask. Slowly, they all stopped what they were doing and looked at me. I didn't wait for an invitation to leave. I turned to run back up the stairs. But as soon as I spun around, I ran straight into someone. He was huge, a mountain of a man blocking my escape. His face wasn't covered, and his expression was tight with urgency, as well as anger.
What are you doing here?
I stammered something about being lost, about thinking I was at the wrong house. He didn't seem to hear me. He grabbed my arm with a vice grip and started dragging me back toward the basement.
Sorry, lady, but you've seen too much.
Panic kicked in, and I did the only thing I could think of. I bit down on his arm, hard. He let out a yell and loosened his grip just enough for me to pull free. I bolted up the stairs, my shoes slipping on the polished wood. Behind me, I could hear the commotion as the others shouted, their voices rising in panic. I bursted through the front door and didn't stop running. My car was still down the street, but the thought of fumbling with my keys kept me moving on foot. I cut through yards, jumped fences, and ignored the barking dogs that chased after me. My lungs burned and my legs felt like they were going to give out. But I couldn't stop. As I rounded a corner, I nearly collided with a woman coming out of her house. She looked familiar, and it took me a second to place her. She was the last guest who had rented the house. Her face twisted into a mix of surprise and desperation when she recognized me.
Hey, you're the owner. What are you doing here? Come inside. This is a big misunderstanding.
Her grip was stronger than it should have been. I tried to pull away, but she held on, yelling toward the street. A few seconds later, the giant from the house appeared, running toward us. He was absolutely furious. I struggled harder, kicking and twisting until I managed to break free from her grip. The man reached just as I stumbled back. He lunged at me, grabbing my shoulders and slamming me against the side of the house. My head spun from the impact, but I didn't stop fighting. I clawed at his face, kicked at his shins, anything to get him off me. Before he could drag me back into the house, a group of neighbors came out onto their porches. A father and his two grown sons approached cautiously, trying to intervene. The giant let go of me and turned his attention to them. He swung a massive fist, connecting with the father's jaw and sending him to the ground. One of the sons tried to tackle him, but the man easily shoved him away. The distraction was all I needed. I turned and ran again, this time heading for the main road. I didn't look back to see if the woman or the giant were following me. I just ran. I reached a gas station a few blocks away and finally stopped. My hands were shaking as I pulled out my phone and dialed 911. I gave them the address of the house and tried to explain what I'd seen. As I spoke, I kept glancing back down the road, half expecting the giant to appear out of nowhere. The operator assured me that officers were on their way and told me to stay put. I wanted to believe them, but part of me was terrified that the police wouldn't get there in time. Minutes felt like hours as I waited. Every car that passed made my heart race. When the first police car finally pulled into the gas station, I felt such a strong wave of relief. It nearly brought me to my knees. It didn't take long for the police to secure the area. I watched from a safe distance as more cars arrived, followed by a DEA team. The officers moved in quickly, surrounding the house. I couldn't see much from where I was standing, but I could hear the shouts and the muffled sound of a battering ram breaking down the door. The raid lasted about an hour. When it was over, the police brought out several people in handcuffs, including the giant and the woman who grabbed me. They looked disheveled and furious, their eyes darting around as if searching for a way out of this. The house was declared a crime scene, and the police confirmed that it had been used as a meth lab. The cleanup process was going to be extensive, and the damage to the property was beyond repair. Airbnb contacted me later to apologize and offered to cover the costs. But it didn't matter. I knew I could never rent the house again. The people who had been arrested were part of a larger operation, one that had been under investigation for months. The unexpected visit to the house brought everything to light, a reality I couldn't avoid any longer. I moved to a new city, changed my number, and I tried to put it all behind me. Sometimes, though, I dream about the giant and the woman. In my nightmares, they're still chasing me, still trying to drag me back to that basement. I wake up in a cold sweat, my heart pounding, reminding myself that it's over.